Welcome to Developing Pakistan Conversations, a space for discussion about critical issues shaping Pakistan's development path. In this conversation, how exactly does education influence attitudes towards terrorism in Pakistan? Madiha Afzal, assistant professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, explains what surveys tell us about this question and their implications for using education as a tool to fight terrorism. She spoke to Rabia Malik, research fellow at the Institute of Development and Economic Alternatives.
Thank you, Madiha, for recording this podcast with us. I'll begin by asking you what got you interested in researching the relationship between education and support for terrorism.
Thanks, Rabia. So I have been, for a number of years, I've been interested in looking at the roots of support for terrorism in Pakistan because of the poor security situation there. You know, it was a topic very much at the sort of the front of my mind. And the idea for looking at support for terrorism is because support matters in the Pakistani context. It legitimizes terror groups. It legitimizes government or it delegitimizes government action against these groups. So the way, you know, people have looked at this topic in general is to relate the support for terrorism to socio demographics, years of education, income levels, and so on. And the way they've done this is basically correlated these variables with support measures of support that are gleaned using polling data. You know, what are your views towards the Taliban? What are your views towards Al Qaeda, and so on? And the conventional wisdom that less education or less income are correlated with support for terrorism, according to these studies, and even in the Pakistani context, all of the work that had been done did not bear out the conventional wisdom. So essentially, the evidence did not really say much, but it did say that we cannot definitively say that less education or less income predicts support for terrorism. So I wanted to retest this a little bit more carefully in the Pakistani context. And, you know, the intuition is that years of education do matter, right? They should matter. You know, the fact that you're going to school should matter for predicting attitudes. Yet in Pakistan, we have very counterintuitive aspects to this issue, like anecdotal support for terrorist groups, for the Taliban, let's say, from very educated people. And so, again, that was sort of the motivation for testing it. When I went ahead and looked at this using polling data from Pew, using polling data from the Program on International Policy Attitudes, I found some really interesting results that then prompted me to start looking at this question in more detail. I realized that it is not only years of education that matter. In fact, they sort of hide something, and one should look much more closely at curricula and be able to say something more about what it is in the content of education that impacts attitude. So that's when I started doing field work in Pakistani schools, especially in government schools, and looked at textbooks and curricula and related that to attitudes of students.
If education and economic background do not necessarily determine support for terrorism, do they influence the role that someone plays in terrorism? So what we're trying to get at is that perhaps the underprivileged are more likely to commit acts, while the privileged are more likely to be thought leaders or organizers. So for example, during the Mumbai terrorist attacks, the soldiers on the ground were commenting about all the expensive things that they saw in the hotel to a commander who could speak in English. So is this something that we can be certain of given available evidence?
Yeah, so let me actually just briefly explain. They don't influence support for terrorism. That's what the data found up till my research.
Right.
I found some interesting results that then prompted me to look a little bit deeper. So I'll go through some of those results with you, and then we can get to the question about, you know, the role someone plays in terrorism. So when one in polling data asks the question about people's views towards the Taliban, right? They can respond in one of three ways. They can say, I have favorable views, they can say, I have unfavorable views, or they can choose not to respond. So a lot of this analysis that had found no effect essentially just chose to look at favorability, right? Along one dimension, but this is sort of a three-dimensional issue. If you look at favorability and unfavorability and non-responses, which basically say that people choose not to respond either out of fear or perhaps because they don't even have enough information to respond. So what I found was that if you split up these the responses into these three dimensions, what you see is that favorability for terrorist groups does not vary much with education. That is true. It does go up slightly towards the kind of the middle levels of education, which is basically secondary education, metric and intermediate education. So some secondary school and going to grades 11 and 12. So that's interesting. Now, that effect is not super strong, but it exists. So that's what prompted me to look at the secondary education further. But the other interesting thing that you do find is that unfavorability is driven up with years of education because non-response rates go down. So basically, uneducated people will have low favorability, also low unfavorability towards terror groups because many of them will just choose not to answer the question. But as you move forward in sort of the years of education, essentially favorability, you know, has sort of a little bit of an upside down U. Where it goes up only for the secondary school a little bit and then comes down again, but unfavorability towards so negative views towards terror groups do increase and non-response rates do go down. So people become more confident in expressing their views, and certainly, you know, views do become more negative as education increases. So that result is a little bit heartening, and in some sense it shows you that part of what education is supposed to accomplish, right? You know, make people more negative towards these groups is being accomplished.
Right, and so on the link between sort of the role that someone plays in terrorism.
That's a very interesting question, and definitely a very sort of an important angle with which to examine the question. It makes logical sense, right? That the privileged are the ones who can sort of think much more about these grander schemes, and the underprivileged are the ones who are sort of the foot soldiers, if you will. But I think that thinking just in general about what makes someone a terrorist, regardless of whatever role they're playing in terrorism, means it is not something that can be predicted by their education or their income quite simply, right? I mean, there's usually something else that has gone on when somebody becomes a terrorist. You know, there's some sense of deep alienation, something flipping their head to the other side. So support for terrorism, while it may be linked to someone becoming a terrorist, there's usually something that flips, which basically means that the link is quite tenuous. So I think these factors are usually much more important than social demographics. But thinking a little bit more about the social demographics, are they likely to be, are people who are committing acts of terror, are they likely to be more underprivileged relative to the general population that they're coming from? So I think that's sort of an important question there. So in the Pakistani context, there have been some studies done non-systematic on terrorists in about a few years ago, but more recently, because the data on terrorists is pretty secretive by the government, by the intelligence agencies. The data isn't really out there for us to examine. What we have are reports of people like Saad Aziz, who was, by all accounts, educated and privileged, who did go on to become a foot soldier, right? And then we also have the thought leaders, let's say Mullah Omar, who is not educated, not privileged. So we have those anecdotal accounts, but we don't really have a systematic understanding of these issues in Pakistan. That being said, I think even in the context of looking at recruits over the world, you know, for recruits going to ISIS, for instance, what the research is finding is that the foot soldiers are not necessarily those who are underprivileged. And in fact, you know, they're usually either enrolled in college. We have examples of terrorists committing acts in the United States who we have Umar Mateen, we have the San Bernardino killer, again, who are not necessarily underprivileged relative to the population that they come from, but there is a sense of sort of deep alienation and resentment, and again, something flipping in their head, which prompts them to go the other way.
You argue that anti-extremism efforts within education should focus on content in Pakistan's curriculum. Is that a correct assumption of what you've written?
Yes, in the public education system, you know, there's some nuance to that,
right.
And I can elaborate on that. But I think in particular, some of the work I've done more recently, I would argue that one of the ways to counter extremism in Pakistan is actually very simply to direct the efforts at madrasas that propagate extremist ideologies. So that is kind of a direct link, and the link with public education, as I can explain in a little bit, is a little bit more nuanced, but it's certainly a place where anti-extremism efforts can be directed.
So can you give us some prominent examples of educational content that could influence people towards extremist and hateful ideologies?
Sure. So again, concentrating on public education or the government education system, where I've examined textbooks, it's not that these textbooks have anything on directly on terrorist groups, right? So it's not like they're saying anything about current events, and even the mentions on terrorism are literally numbered one or two mentions of terrorism, basically saying Pakistan is playing a good role in the world in countering terrorism, or Pakistan is a victim of terrorism. So there's nothing directly mentioning terrorist groups. But what I argue influences people's views, influences students' views, are a number of sort of structures in the Pakistani educational curricula. And I focus on the Pakistan Studies curriculum at the secondary level. These are that, Pakistan, sort of the first thing that the curriculum starts out with is that the Pakistan ideology is Islam. That is, Pakistan is created for Islam. And it goes on to say that, basically that Muslims are good, that non-Muslims are not, even though there's some lip service to the view that minorities are equal. But essentially the content of the first few chapters in particular, where it's sort of explaining the creation of the country and partition, is that, Muslims were good, sort of Hindus were bad, and hence Pakistan needed to be created. And there are references to jihad as an armed struggle against those of a different religion in the colonial context, fighting against Sikhs, fighting against the British. And the references to India are pretty pretty starkly negative, you know, and Hindus, you know, before partition, evil, calling them the enemy and so on. And there's a sense that pervades the textbooks that the world is sort of out to get Pakistan. When it came to 1971, the world was sort of out to get Pakistan, and in particular, India conspired against Pakistan. And so what these narratives, what this kind of skeleton of a narrative that is set up, without it, you know, it should be mentioned, without any sort of critical thinking or any views from the other side, you know, any views from, you know, what might Indians think being put in there. What this sets up is a view of the world where then when a terrorist group comes out and says that we are only committing acts of terror because we want to purge Pakistan of foreign influences and Western influences and impose Islam. And we are engaging in jihad against sort of an infidel state to impose an Islamic system. A student who has not really understood the the nuances of the Pakistan argument will read that narrative from coming from terrorists, or will hear that narrative coming from terrorists and say, you know, what's wrong with that? It causes them to develop a narrative in their heads that then when they encounter sort of hateful propaganda or terrorist propaganda, they can't counter that.
So can we say that this content has been causal for supporting terrorism? Couldn't support also be a reaction to global politics and foreign policy?
Yeah, so one thing I'll say is that it's not causal in the sense that many countries, right? So Pakistan is not exclusive in having sort of this narrative in its textbooks, this negativity towards this kind of very hyper-nationalist narrative, this negativity towards other countries, other religions. It's certainly not exclusive. You know, there have been examples in sort of Israeli and Palestinian textbooks. There are plenty of examples in Indian textbooks where there are examples that would coincide with sort of the trends that we see in Pakistani textbooks. So it's not causal for developing, let's say, support for terrorism. Well, because one thing I'll say is that despite the fact that the majority of the country reads these textbooks, you know, actual support for terrorism, when you measure it, it's pretty low, right? In these polls. So maybe we should have sort of discussed that that upfront. But you know, support for terrorism is on average around 10 to 15%. Of people will say, yes, we have favorable views towards the Taliban. Of course, their narratives are much more worrying, and that's one thing I argue in my work. But coming back to your question, we cannot say then that it's causal in developing support for terrorism. However, given that Pakistan has this curriculum, and then given that Pakistan has the environment it has, where certain terrorist groups are able to sort of propagate their narratives freely. I mean, there's hate literature that you can buy in, there are magazines of these jihadist groups that you can buy literally in stores in some parts of Lahore. There are certainly mosques and madrasas and where the narratives are being propagated sometimes during Friday prayers. The idea is when that kind of environment exists, and there's a sort of obviously a whole set of reasons why that kind of environment exists in Pakistan, and some of that is actually global politics and some of that is foreign policy. When that kind of environment exists and when this kind of curriculum exists, there is a sense that if this curriculum did not exist, then, you know, the counterfactual is that then perhaps, or if there were critical thinking in this curriculum, then people could counter some of the narratives coming out in that environment. So while the curriculum may not be causal towards developing support for terrorism, had the curriculum been different, people might have been able to, or students might be able to counter some of the narratives that are out there.
And I think it'd be fair to say even that almost an enabling environment is created. So while not everybody chooses to pick up arms, while not everybody chooses to act outside of the law or violently, there's an enabling environment that's created, particularly in weak states or in parts of the state that are weak.
Yeah, absolutely.
So why do textbooks have this content in the first place, and what prevents them from changing?
Yeah, so the text, I mean, that's a great question, because the question is why don't we just engage in a curriculum reform? And a curriculum reform has been tried and essentially failed, though there have been some improvements at the margins. The reason textbooks have this content in the first place is because this is a conscious effort by the Pakistani state to promote its narrative, a narrative that it considers to be of use to it. So essentially, textbooks weren't always this way. So the Pakistan studies, actually, Pakistan studies only became compulsory at sort of the higher secondary levels and beyond, and the secondary levels and beyond around the late 1970s. And this sort of coincided with happened during Zia's regime, and basically General Zia, along with the help of the Jamaat-e-Islami, inserted these notions of the Pakistan ideology, not the two-nation theory. I mean, the two-nation theory already exists in these textbooks, but the Pakistan ideology, the fact that the Pakistan ideology is identical essentially to Islam, is something that was inserted in these textbooks in the late 70s, early 1980s. Similarly, sort of the more negative content towards India also was inserted in the textbooks at that time. And the idea is that it serves Pakistan's interests to be a country that identifies itself or that defines itself in opposition to India, and that it defines itself on the basis of religion, because that cements the Pakistani identity, an identity that I think was threatened, or Pakistan felt, the state felt that it was threatened, in particular post-1971 when East Pakistan seceded from it. And essentially what prevents it from changing, is that sort of this is a conscious narrative of the Pakistani establishment, and that, you know, the establishment is pretty constant through various military and civilian regimes, through various kinds of various democratic governments, but what prevents it from changing is also the fact that now an entire generation and more now has been schooled in this. So when Musharraf came in and argued for curriculum reform in Pakistan, and for instance argued for the word jihad to be taken out of the curriculum, and in fact the curriculum documents of, you know, the 2006 curriculum document does not have, says that, you know, does not have the word jihad for it to be included in the Pakistan studies curriculum. Instructions or those suggestions to textbook writers were basically not taken into account, because an entire generation, as I said, of textbook writers, of people working in the curriculum wing and the textbook boards, has been schooled in this curriculum, and in interviews with them, they said, you know, we saw the document which says the word jihad should not be included, but why not? You know, we think the word should be included. And so there's pushback on various levels against this reform, because people buy into the narrative.
In the conversation, we've spoken about how the culture of education or the culture of learning is such that it discourages critical thinking and questioning. And that's linked also to sort of rote memorization and an unquestioning acceptance of the narrative. But yeah. My question is this not a wider issue in society and a broader cultural characteristic? So is it fair to think that changing curricula and what is taught in schools will bring change in society? Or does the sequencing need to be the other way around?
That's a great question. I think you're absolutely right. I think, we're a culture that is very hierarchical, which tends to take things the way they're presented to us, which tends not to question, people in positions of authority. So be that, they could be adults in your household or they could be your teachers, right? You're taught not to question. So I think part of what I argue the curriculum reform should be is a change in this culture. And I'll give you a couple of examples where, even in Pakistan, right, this kind of questioning, et cetera, does exist. So I found in my research that public schools tend to have much more of this kind of authoritative teacher culture, whereas the low-cost private schools, right, and nonprofit schools had a much more kind of friendly teacher who was teaching in a more informal environment where students were asking her or him questions and sort of engaging with them. Again, they may be, this may be sort of to some a marginal difference compared to, let's say, how teaching happens in other contexts. But I would argue that it makes a difference. Similarly, if you think about, so that's one dimension, sort of more engagement with the teachers, being able to ask questions, just being able to understand things logically in your head instead of memorizing them without any questions. I think the other example that I would give is, again, in the Pakistani context, is O-levels curricula. So compared to other contexts, I think, the O-levels curriculum, while it encourages learning as opposed to a lot of questioning or sort of going outside the box, the curriculum itself I studied the Pakistan Studies textbooks for the O-levels curriculum. The textbooks themselves have so many sort of differences with the Pakistan Studies textbooks at the metric level, where they are actually presenting other sides of the story. They are presenting things as not being sort of black and white, right? So it's not that those on the Muslim side, when it came to partition, made no mistakes. In fact, there were mistakes on both sides. Sort of saying very simple things like this can actually make a difference. So I think while it is true on one hand that, it is a culture that kind of discourages critical thinking, I think sort of loosening up the way things are taught, and again in Pakistan it does happen that they're loosened up. I think it's only the government schools that are extremely strict, really trying to elaborate on and insert some nuances in the history of things in the curriculum can make a difference.
So what, just to sort of try and sum up now also, what do you think is the way forward? Has there been any engagement at the policy level on this issue? And realistically, what kind of policy engagement can we envision?
A tough question. I think there is a sense in Pakistan when it comes to education, there is a sense that, you know, curricula are sort of on the back burner, you know, because Pakistan has so many issues when it comes to access to education, and because it's often in the news because of access to education first, and then issues of learning at the elementary school level, at the primary school level, you know, learning math, learning English. It seems that the government, you know, whenever you talk about curricula, the government seems to be concentrating its efforts on those two issues. So policy really doesn't seem to be very concerned with looking at curricula as an important initiative. There is a sense that, you know, people know that this work is being done. You know, it's prominently written about, in opinion articles that I'm sure are being read. The reports are disseminated. And so the government certainly is aware that there are scholars who argue that the curriculum is a problem in Pakistan. To the extent that it would run in the face of the state's narrative, which does not show any signs of changing, no, I don't think that it's going to sort of change substantially at any point soon. In fact, even when it comes to when it comes to madrasas that are sort of more extremist, right, and hate literature and hate kind of hateful curricula being taught in extremist madrasas, where the link is actually much more direct, and where that was actually part of the National Action Plan, was to sort of completely eliminate any signs of that. The sense is that a lot of the work that's been done on that is by the government is pretty haphazard. So, you know, we see newspaper sort of reports of, 100 madrasas shut down here, 50 parcels of hate material seized there, but no kind of evidence that the action against these things has been systematic. So in some sense, that is the primary that should be the primary or the first target by the government, especially because the government itself acknowledged it and put it in the National Action Plan. But to the extent that this is not even, you know, public school curricula or government school curricula are not even on the government's kind of list of things that they say are going to be tackled anytime soon, I think any hope for that is at this point, in my view, pretty muted.
Developing Pakistan Conversations is a co-production of the Consortium for Development Policy Research and the Institute of Development and Economic Alternatives. If you liked what you heard, it would help us a lot if you shared this conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or another social media platform of your choice. We also appreciate comments and feedback, which you can leave in the comment section of this episode at devpakistan.com/conversations. For clearly written, cutting-edge insights about development issues in Pakistan, ranging from the economy, to agriculture, to governance, to gender equality, and more, check out our blog, Developing Pakistan, at devpakistan.com. Once again, that's devpakistan.com. Thanks for listening.